This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Well, this hour, we're going to continue our week-long look at what freedom means in modern-day America. We're asking you to weigh in on this. What is your freedom story? You can tweet it to us at The Takeaway. Use the hashtag FreedomIs. And later this hour, New Yorker writer Jill Lepore talks about the history of freedom and privacy going all the way back to the Founding Fathers. This part will surprise you. In a way, there's really very little that's new to the NSA surveillance story. Listen for that. Plus, Iran's John Stewart talks about this week's elections and why he's still laughing, and a look at some big decisions by the Supreme Court, including a ruling on voter registration laws. But we begin with President Barack Obama's defense of the NSA's surveillance programs last night. Listen.
We have to make decisions about how much classified information and how much covert activity we are willing to tolerate as a society.
As President Obama, he sat down for a 45-minute interview with Charlie Rose that aired last night on PBS. He also said he's no Dick Cheney.
The whole point of my concern before I was president, because some people say, well, you know, Obama was this raving liberal before, now he's, you know, Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney sometimes says, yeah, you know, he took it all lock, stock, and barrel. My concern has always been not that we shouldn't do intelligence gathering to prevent terrorism, but rather, are we setting up a systems of checks and balances? So on this telephone program, you've got a federal court with independent federal judges overseeing the entire program, and you've got Congress overseeing the program.
The explainer in chief there, President Obama. Now, he would not comment on how or if NSA leaker Edward Snowden would be prosecuted. That's being handled by the Department of Justice, he said. But with Snowden in semi-hiding in Hong Kong, how he could be extradited and get back to the United States could get complicated for the United States. Now, with us to explore the Obama administration's options is Ashley Deeks, a University of Virginia law professor, former State Department advisor on matters of extradition. Hi, Professor.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. We do appreciate it. It's potentially complicated. Edward Snowden chose Hong Kong, he says, because of their rich history of free speech respect, but also because it's not a clear-cut extradition situation, is it?
Well, I think it will prove to be somewhat complicated as a legal matter, although extradition generally can get somewhat complicated. I don't know that there's anything particularly complicated in Hong Kong that you might not see in a couple of other places he might have chosen.
Did he choose wisely in terms of his own self-preservation, I guess is the question.
Well, I think what we will see is the process playing out over a relatively long period of time. Extraditions don't usually happen in an extremely fast period of time, and I think we could envision this taking months or years
to get him legally extradited if that's what they choose to do.
That's correct.
Now, there are lots, and like with anything else, there are lots of legal precedents here. I read about some of them in Talking Points Memo in an article that I think you participated in by Brian Beutler, which was interesting. There are precedents, for instance, cases in Mexico with drug cartels. What sort of informs how easy it's going to be for U.S. diplomats to get Snowden arrested and extradited?
Well, so a part of it has to do with the capacities and the will of the requested state, that is the state to whom the United States will make an extradition request. And part of it has to do with the kinds of criminal charges that the United States might be seeking to extradite the person on. So, for example, if it is a straightforward murder case or a straightforward narcotics case, those tend to progress somewhat faster. I think the kinds of offenses that we might see in play here make it a little bit more complicated because they are politically tinged.
And to some, he is a freedom fighter. To others, he's just a leaker. You know, not a freedom fighter, of course, but a whistleblower.
That's
and
right.
Has some support in Hong Kong. So politically tinged is right. And here's another thing that a lot of people are questioning. The political relationship with Hong Kong is a lot less complicated than with the PRC, with the People's Republic of China.
That's right. Their
relationship with Hong Kong is not so clear-cut. What are we dealing with here?
So within the treaty itself, there is a contemplation that the government of China might have a say in certain extraditions related to Chinese nationals. Now, that's not the case we're dealing with here. So under the treaty, it looks like it's a pretty straightforward government-to-government relationship. Where I think it gets complicated is in Hong Kong's domestic laws. And from what I can ascertain and from what I've read that Hong Kong legal experts are saying, it appears that the Chinese government has an opportunity to opine on extraditions pro and con where it believes that its defense or national security is implicated.
And this is going to be, no matter what it is, it's going to be high profile. There's a lot at stake besides the well-being of Edward Snowden in the relationship between Beijing and Washington. I like to think in my sort of political fantasies that Beijing has a trump card here. No matter what Hong Kong decides, Beijing can politically, behind closed doors, say, no, this is what you're going to do.
I guess that's right, although it is the way the extradition process works, it tends to involve the requested state's system, the involvement of both the executive branch and the judiciary. And I think we will see that here as well. It's certainly how it happens here in the United States. And there may be different perspectives on whether it is appropriate to intervene based on a judicial decision versus where there's more discretion for the Hong Kong executive.
But either way we slice it, Ashley Deeks, we're dealing with a scenario that's probably years, not months, correct?
That sounds right to me.
In our negotiations with Hong Kong and potentially the PRC.
That's right.
Well, Ashley Deeks is a University of Virginia law professor, former State Department advisor on matters of extradition, and expert on matters of extradition. You can read more from Ashley Deeks in that article I mentioned on Talking Points memo by Brian Beutler, all about the United States options when it comes to grabbing or extraditing Edward Snowden. Well, as we just heard, the U.S. has some limited options when it comes to extraditing NSA leaker Edward Snowden from Hong Kong back to the United States. Now, Snowden has announced his intention to stay in Hong Kong. And though Hong Kong maintains its own judiciary and educational system with some autonomy from Beijing, the region technically is part of China and has an extradition agreement with the United States. It's the newest hotspot in an unstable Sino-U.S. relationship. Now, over the past several days, several hundred people have organized demonstrations in support of Ed Snowden's appeal to remain in Hong Kong. For more on the political pressures that Hong Kong's leaders may face should the U.S. try to get Ed Snowden, Emily Lau, chairperson of Hong Kong's Democratic Party and a member of Hong Kong's Legislative Council. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. What can you tell us about the campaign to protect Edward Snowden from extradition there in Hong Kong? U.S. authorities would love to have him. What's it like there?
Well, I don't think it's a very well-organized campaign, but it is safe to say that many Hong Kong people regard Mr. Snowden as a hero. And in fact, many of us would like to see a number of whistleblowers in Hong Kong who will tell us what the government is up to. So people are sympathetic, and they don't think he should be sent back to America. But right now, I don't think the American government has made any overture to the Hong Kong government, and so we are all waiting. And of course, there is this extradition treaty, but there are all the legal procedures there. But if Mr. Snowden decides to seek political asylum or to make a torture claim, then we will also have the procedure to deal with that. And I've spoken to people inside government and outside, and many suspect that this case will probably drag on for years. And the most significant thing, and the reason why Mr. Snowden has chosen to come to Hong Kong, probably is our independent judiciary. If you look around Asia, I think you would be very hard-pressed to find a judiciary that's more independent and have higher integrity than our Hong Kong judges. So Mr. Snowden's fate is not just in the hands of the Hong Kong people, but in the hands of the Hong Kong judges.
Well, speaking of that independence of the judiciary, Emily Lau, one of the questions here in the United States is the relationship between Hong Kong and Beijing. Of course, as I mentioned, Hong Kong has some autonomy. They do have their own extradition treaty with the United States. But everybody here believes that if this were a really sensitive diplomatic situation, which inevitably it would be if the U.S. tried to request extradition, that Beijing could just pull rank over Hong Kong and order his extradition if they wanted to, in a political sense. Is that your understanding of the relationship? Pull back the cover on that for us.
Well, I cannot profess to be the world's expert on this. And in fact, we're going to have a debate in the Legislative Council tomorrow, and we hope the administration, the officials who come to take part, will tell us more. But as I said, we have our own judicial and legal system. Our judiciary is fearlessly independent. So whatever course Mr. Snowden or the American government chooses to take, and Mr. Snowden can, you know, reply by saying that he does not agree. He doesn't want to be sent back. And so the case inevitably will end up in our courts, and it will go from the High Court and to the Court of Appeal and the Court of Final Appeal. And our judges and our whole, all the Hong Kong people will see to it that the proper procedure will be adopted.
This sounds like it has the potential to become a test of the relationship between Hong Kong and Beijing. It could come to that.
Well, certainly. And it must be a big test of this policy of one country, two systems, which is a policy that Beijing has made for Hong Kong. Under one country, two systems, although we are part of the People's Republic of China, but we are a special administrative region enjoying a high degree of autonomy and having our own judiciary, our own court of final appeal. So whatever happens, the procedures that will be adopted will be a huge challenge to one country, two systems. If the whole system does not measure up, then I tell you, there's going to be hell to pay.
Edward Snowden challenging the secrecy of the American security services, also potentially challenging the relationship between Hong Kong and the People's Republic of China. Emily Lau, chairperson of Hong Kong's Democratic Party and a member of the Legislative Council, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, speaking of hell to pay, how are you Miami Heat fans feeling these days? Your league favorite isn't so white hot, are they? Well, Game 6 of the NBA Finals is tonight, and the Heat are on the brink of elimination against the Spurs. We're taking a cue from our friends at WLRN in Miami and asking you, for your sports superstitions, what do you do to help root for your team?
This is Jason from Portland, Oregon. When I have something to throw away on game day, I always get up and walk it to the trash, because I know if I shoot and I miss, I've doomed my team.
There's a superstition. Pete from Stillwater, Oklahoma, texted us to say that he keeps his mom away from the TV, radio, and games because she's horrible luck. And a listener from Oklahoma City writes, I always wear an OU shirt on game day and put my daughter in her cheerleading outfit. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. Later this hour, a Supreme Court decision with major consequences for voter registration. That's coming up. Well, certainly voter registration has been controversial in this country over the last few years. In the 2012 election, voting rights groups filed lawsuits in Pennsylvania, in Florida, Georgia, and Massachusetts, and a whole bunch of other states. But one Arizona law has been tied up in the courts for years, since 2006, in fact. Back then, a voter-approved proposition went into effect. It required would-be voters in Arizona to show documented proof of citizenship, like a passport or a birth certificate or a driver's license. Now, this was all supposed to combat voter fraud. Listen.
The Obama administration argued against us in the Ninth Circuit. They're not only unwilling to protect our border, but they want illegals to vote. And hopefully, I will win this case in the U.S. Supreme Court to establish the principle that we're allowed to ask for evidence of citizenship when people register, so only citizens will vote in our state.
That's Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn there speaking in 2013. Now, this proposition, though, also, in addition to trying to crack down on voter fraud, also curbed civic participation altogether. In Maricopa County alone in Arizona, voter registration dropped by 44%. After that proposition took effect. Well, this week, in a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court ruled against that Arizona law. And in an opinion by Justice Antonin Scalia, the court said Arizona has to use a federal voter form, which does not require prospective voters to show proof of citizenship. Federal law takes precedence over state propositions. Kareem Creighton is professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law and joins me in studio now for more on the decision. Hi, Professor.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Well, thanks for being here. First, tell us about the law Proposition 200 and the original challenge. There certainly, as I said, voter registration has been controversial. On its face, showing proof of citizenship, you have to be a citizen to vote. So what was the problem?
Well, as far as the Arizona law is concerned, there was a number of propositions and initiatives on the part of Arizonans to try to curb the influx of non-citizens into the population. This was one of the ways in which they tried to do it, partly, I think, reacting to some of the corruption claims that were made about people who weren't being necessarily going through the typical citizenship process, going into the voting polls and voting. They thought that this would be an extra way, in addition to using the criminal law, to prevent non-citizens from voting. So it was very popular. It passed overwhelmingly, despite strong opposition from the Latino community, in particular in Arizona. But it was on the books, and Arizona attempted to enforce it. Unfortunately for them, the federal government had a different viewpoint.
Now, did the Supreme Court in this case, when they struck this law down that you just described, did they really say that asking for a driver's license or a birth certificate is a bad thing? Or did they simply say, there's already a law higher up in Washington, and that's the point?
And this is important. I'm glad you pointed it out. The Supreme Court actually in other cases has actually upheld the view that actually a state can, in its own right, ask for voter ID for the purpose of verifying that you are who you say you are. That's in another case out of Indiana. In this case, what they're saying is there is a federal provision that establishes basically at a time where you're eligible for other social services, the motor voter law allows you to get into the registration system just by filling out a form. In this case, Arizona says, well, we don't think that form is sufficient because our law says, in addition to the things that you ask for, we want proof of citizenship. The Supreme Court says in this case, essentially, well, you can't force the federal government, at least as a facial matter, to put your information on the form that's required under the federal statute. But, and this is the big thing that you should be looking out for next, what Justice Scalia said was, well, this might not be the only way in which you can get this as part of the system. You can ask the federal government through an administrative process to include it if you show that it's really important to some state concern. And so Scalia is saying,
send them back to the drawing board.
You sent them back to the drawing board, but actually give them a roadmap, Justice Scalia did, about how to make the argument that it's important, it's necessary to have this information included on the federal form. And if it's not, then you can come back to court and challenge it pursuant to administrative rules.
Meanwhile, this case is certainly a voter ID case, a voter fraud case. It's also sort of part immigration case because we heard the state attorney general there basically saying, look, the opponents of this proposition want illegals to be able to vote. Yes, it's about voting, but it's also about Arizona's controversial stance on immigration. Now, this is the second time, right, that the Supreme Court has taken a swing at Arizona. Parts of the famous SB 1070 last year were struck down. So this is there. One is immigration, one's voter fraud. I get that. But this is an ongoing sort of roster of cases here.
Precisely. And that was the point I was attempting to make earlier that, you know, Arizona, at least right now, is in a political position of challenging in all forms ways of encouraging, in their view, non-citizens from coming into their population and enjoying benefits. And one of those benefits, as you point out in this case, is the right to vote. And you see the confluence in some ways of the way in which the court has looked at immigration and what states can and can't do to enforce mandates, because that's another area where the federal government actually has priority in establishing rules, and in voting, another place where the federal government has priority in establishing rules.
And is it before we let you go, is it as simple now then as federal government to Jan Brewer and Arizona, nothing? I mean, is it that simple or is it?
For now, but we're in the second inning if we're going to use the baseball analogy.
And more cases to come.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So federal government versus Jan Brewer, if you want to take the 30,000-foot view with Kareem Creighton, professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law, looking at a voter rights decision in the Supreme Court, 7-2, striking down a decision, striking down a law in Arizona requiring proof of citizenship to vote. Professor, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, today, Republicans in the GOP-controlled House of Representatives are going to vote on one of the most restrictive abortion bills in many, many years. The bill is sponsored by Representative Trent Franks of Arizona, a state we've just been talking about. It seeks to ban abortions after a woman has been pregnant for more than 22 weeks. Now, the bill does not have a chance of becoming law, and you know why. Democrats control the Senate and they control the White House. But similar measures in state legislatures controlled by Republicans are gaining some traction in jurisdictions all across the country. To discuss the GOP's effort to restrict access to abortion, we have Molly Ball, my colleague and staff writer for The Atlantic. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Todd.
Good to have you. Well, as I just mentioned, the bill that the House is going to vote on isn't going to change national abortion policy. It's not going anywhere. President Obama would never sign it. But this says a lot more about the GOP than about any new laws, doesn't it?
Yes, I believe it tells you something, first of all, about the internal dynamics of the House Republican caucus, where Speaker John Boehner is always having to defend his right flank and sort of placate the conservatives in his caucus. I think it also tells us a lot about the clout that social conservatism still has within the Republican coalition. You know, as Republicans keep trying to pick up the pieces from 2012 and figure out how to move forward, there are some voices, particularly younger and more moderate voices, encouraging the parties to sort of back off the culture war. But there's also a very large and institutionalized segment of conservatives who want the party to double down on things like restricting abortion and banning gay marriage. And they're encouraging things like this particular bill.
Why isn't the former view, the view that was supposed to be one of the lessons learned from Mitt Romney's loss to Barack Obama in 2012, that they need to step away from social concerns, be more relevant to younger people, not be the party of the far right? Why does that seem to have washed away, or is this just a hiccup?
I think this is still an ongoing debate, but let's be clear, there are a lot of Americans who believe these things. It is a minority view, but it's a very large minority view that, for example, there should not be any access to abortion, or, you know, gay marriage has just recently become a majority view among American voters, but it's a very slim, maybe a 51-52% majority in most of the polls that you see. So there's a very large number of Americans who believe these things, and if they don't have a home in the Republican Party, they really don't have a home politically. The question, I think, is one of emphasis. I don't think anybody thinks that Republicans are suddenly going to become a pro-choice political party.
Right.
It's do they need to be emphasizing these things and really giving Democrats a political weapon, you know, for the Democratic argument that had so much success in 2012, the whole narrative about the war on women and trying to take away your contraception and sort of putting the Democrats in the driver's seat of the culture war.
So in a way, Republicans need to give voice to an important part of their base. That's politics. We all get that. As far as timing, this might be the ideal time to make sure that your base is happy. Sort of bury it in a non-election year, have the vote. Everybody can go home and say, I voted for this if they want to, and it's not right before an election.
Yeah, I guess that is one argument behind it. I don't think it's quite that deliberate or organized. Again, I think if you look at the internal dynamics in the House, we see a speaker who's quite weak, who does not have a lot of control over his caucus, and who has to throw them a lot of bones just to make sure that he keeps his position. So, you know, we have a fight coming up over immigration. If that goes through the House, it's probably going to go through with a lot of Democratic votes. And so the speaker may be trying to do some favors for the conservatives in order to give himself a little bit of cover in that case.
The ongoing politics of abortion and the ongoing struggles of a Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner, trying to manage a restive and conservative House Republican conference. That's Molly Ball, political reporter for The Atlantic. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, for millions and millions of American kids and their parents, Sesame Street was there when they learned how to count or learn the alphabet or learned how to share. But how's this for a lesson on Sesame Street? Listen.
All this talk about my dad and where he is got me really upset.
Oh, because your daddy's away?
And you miss him?
Yeah, but because of where he is, too. My dad's in jail.
In jail? Why?
I don't like to talk about it. Most people don't understand.
For the first time, Sesame Street is reaching out to kids with incarcerated parents in a new initiative called Little Children, Big Challenges, Incarceration. Mike Riggs, an associate editor at Reason Magazine, recently blogged about the Sesame Street program, writing, "Congratulations, America, on making it almost normal to have a parent in prison or jail." Mike Riggs joins me now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks for being on. A little bit sarcastic there, but the point is taken. When once a Muppet is giving voice to a problem that one in 28 kids have, it's a pretty entrenched problem.
Yeah, and it's been an entrenched problem for a while, actually. I mean, our prison population in the U.S. peaked in 2007. It's come down, you know, a couple hundred thousand since then. We still have, you know, almost 7 million people under some form of correctional supervision, ranging from either prison, jail, probation, parole, halfway houses, something like that. So it's, you know, I don't actually blame Sesame Street for normalizing what, you know, a child having a parent in prison, but it's, I think Sesame Street is reacting to the normalization of that. So, you know, once you feel that a much loved and largely positive children's show has to address this, that's sort of alarming.
It can be alarming, and yet the benefit for those 1 in 28 children to hear a conversation like that might be extremely beneficial to the child.
Oh, I definitely think it is. There's still a sort of problem, though, that maybe you can make, you know, a third grader who has a parent in jail or prison, maybe you can make them feel a little more normal, or maybe you can help their classmates understand what they're going through. But the we're never going to be able to get around the stigma for the parents themselves and their ability to be breadwinners and their ability to support those children. Arrests, jail time, convictions, all of those have really deleterious effects on the ability of people to vote, to get jobs, to get a driver's license, to get an occupational license, to get more higher education or any higher education. So it's sort of, I mean, again, it's like it's great to put a, you know, to put some gauze over the wound, I guess, but there's more serious treatments that need to be done.
Mike Riggs, is there any reason to believe that the normalization that comes with, you know, Sesame Street addressing 1 in 28 children having a parent in jail, that this is an inflection point in the war on drugs and the prison population incarcerating people for drug offenses, or has that inflection point already happened?
I mean, I think this is, I honestly think that November 2012, when Colorado and Washington voters said, you know, they weren't saying we're pro-pot, they're saying we can't, it's obscene to ruin as many lives as we have with this aspect of the drug war and to spend as much money as we have with this aspect of the drug war, so we're going to reverse that. And I think that was sort of an inflection point. You know, the Congress had him, Eric Holder, Attorney General Eric Holder, testified before Congress last week, and several Congress members grilled him over the fact that the Bureau of Prisons absorbs 1/3 of the Department of Justice budget. And, you know, so you have that sort of, there's a sort of defensiveness on the side of people managing the incarceration state. And you also have the House has formed an overcriminalization committee.
That's going to be addressing this as well.
Yeah.
Well, when members of Congress and the Justice Department and perhaps most importantly Sesame Street notice the overcrowding of prisons, it's time to take notice. Mike Riggs, associate editor at Reason Magazine. Mike, thank you. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Now, listen to this. How's this for a radio job for a kid? Listen.
When I was 9 years old, I got picked as a host of this radio show, Children of Revolution Blossom, which was a very popular show back in the 80s during Iran-Iraq War. My job was to brainwash all kids who were my age. And lots of those kids, they would never see their dads again because they get killed in the war. So this show was aimed to prepare these kids and brainwash them to think that if their dad doesn't come home, he's going to a better place in heaven.
That's the voice there of Kambiz Husseini. Born and raised in Iran, Husseini spent parts of his childhood working as the voice of the Iranian government, as you heard there. But today, nearly three decades later, Husseini is living in Brooklyn, here in New York, working as a political satirist and host of the weekly Persian language podcast, 5 in the Afternoon, a show that is banned in Iran.
You know, I grew up in a country that oppressed me all my life. All my life. I wasn't able to talk freely. I wasn't able to express myself freely. I had to have the freedom that I wanted to have inside my home. And when I wanted to go out, I had to lie all the time. But we're trying to transform all this in humor.
That's Kambiz Husseini on The Daily Show in 2011. And through his own political satire, he himself has been called the John Stewart of Iran. And what better time for political satire than during an election? Leading up to Iran's presidential elections this past week, Husseini said, and I'm quoting here, "Becoming the president of Iran is like making a James Bond movie. The characters stay the same, but they just keep changing the actors." Well, the leading star in Iranian politics after this weekend is newly elected President Hassan Rouhani. And while it's unclear whether he's going to change the politics in Iran, Husseini says Rouhani will definitely change his comedy routine.
Ahmadinejad was a gift to me. He wrote my show for last 3 years. He was part of the content crew. As soon as he would open up his mouth, I had the material. Rouhani, on the other hand, he's not like that. He's more sophisticated. And to me, that would change the language of my show. Ahmadinejad used a lot of low talk that wasn't diplomatic in his speeches. So in order for me to bounce that, I had to use the same language. Rouhani is more sophisticated, and he's going to use a lot of logics, probably, in a lot of politics in his speeches. And as a result, my jokes would be more sophisticated also. I have to try more. This is harder.
What about the Ayatollah? Is he off limits? Do people in Tehran, do they want to hear it? Do they want to hear you make fun of
him? Yeah, that guy is funny too, you know. Like last week he said at the poll, when he went to the vote, he said that some American officials said that we don't recognize your election. I would tell them, go to hell. You know, a politician in that level comes on live TV and says, go to hell, you know, America. So that's already, I composed a rap song. With that phrase that I was saying, okay, how about human rights? And he was saying, go to hell. And how women rights? He was saying, go to hell. How about the political prisoners? And he was saying, go to hell. I have to find a way to do it. But Supreme Leader is most likely my new favorite character now.
Now, they call you, as I mentioned before, the John Stewart of Iran, which he's popular. People love him. I suppose is a compliment. But most comedians I know, you know, don't want to be the something of something else. You know, so how do you feel about that?
Look, I'm very thrilled and I'm very honored to be compared with somebody like John Stewart, who I was inspired from. I like the guy. I like the way he changed the face of media and made humor and satire part of our daily life, and his common sense and sanity that he brought to U.S. election, to U.S. politics. I'm just honored to be compared with him.
Now, you're still doing a podcast regularly.
Yeah.
And one question I have, knowing all of the electronic censorship that exists in Iran, slowing down of internet speeds selectively by the government, media is very difficult, downloads, I would assume that you're completely censored electronically in Iran. Is that correct?
That's
so
correct.
How do people get a hold of your stuff? How do you get it in? What do you do?
Well, people use a lot of proxies to get around the filtering of different websites. I do it through Facebook and other sorts of internet forums. And people get what they want to get, you know.
They manage to get it.
Yeah, they manage to get it. And people, look, they download it and they put it on CD. They sell it on the street. They share it with their friends. We had I just started this podcast 20 weeks ago. And we had over a million listeners for 20 weeks with all the limitations that we have.
Well, before we let you go, Kambiz Husseini, I do want to ask, because you're really the only one who can tell me this, what's funny about the Iranian election? I know what's funny about our elections, believe me. What's funny about the election we just had?
Electing Rouhani was a surprise also. He is not a reformist. I would call him a moderate. Even the reformists didn't back him up till last minute. But the latest is that Mr. Rouhani got elected and people got excited and they went on the street. And the first slogan they were chanting, "Dictator, dictator, thank you, thank you." So I think that's the funniest I heard.
Well, let's hope it gets funnier from here on out and not closer to any kind of brink.
I hope so. Otherwise, I have to make things up.
and we wouldn't want that. And I feel for you because, as Kambiz Hosseini says, the new president, Hassan Rouhani, may be a moderate, maybe a reformer, and maybe not, but he's probably not as funny as Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. So that's a problem.
That's a problem.
All right. Kambiz Hosseini is host of the podcast 5 in the Afternoon and is launching a new online TV show, Politique. He joined us in the studio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you. As we've been learning more about the NSA's surveillance programs and leaker Edward Snowden, we've been talking about freedom in America on The Takeaway and freedom's relationship to privacy. And July 4th is just around the corner. And while freedom is part and parcel of our concept of America and our democracy, Thomas Jefferson didn't include the word in the Declaration of Independence, the document we celebrate every 4th of July. It's not in there. Even still, as writer Jill Lepore notes in an article for this week's New Yorker, by the time the United States was founded in Jefferson's time, freedom and privacy were thought to be inherent in democracy. But this hasn't always played out in practice since long before the formation of this republic. Jill Lepore joins us from a studio at Harvard University, where she's a professor of American history. Welcome, Jill.
Hi, thanks.
Thank you for joining us. You talk about sort of the history of privacy and democracy, and what strikes me reading your article in The New Yorker, that there's really nothing new under the sun when it comes to our apparent struggle with privacy and freedom. This is an old, old argument.
Actually, I don't think I agree with that, Todd. I'm sorry. I don't think that the rhetoric of freedom is a big part of the conversation about privacy until very recent times. In fact, privacy has a fascinating history in that it's historically quite bounded. You can't actually have a notion of privacy before the rise of individualism, and privacy itself doesn't really become a catchword or even an aspiration until the emergence of a middle class, which happens after industrialization. So I guess as a historian, that seems to me very recent recent days.
And as a radio host,
looks longer ago to a radio host. I got to get myself out of the past and live more in the present, I guess,
is
the lesson here.
So what was the long view to me was 1844, and you describe in your
yes.
article the case of an Italian national. But in 1844, had his mail read in the United Kingdom. Now, to me, that's a long time ago. To you, it isn't, and I get that. But the example still stands. This goes all the way back to snail mail in 1844.
Sure, absolutely. And really, the mail is a big piece of the story here with the rise of privacy, because privacy really, since it's so closely tied to the rise of individualism, is also closely tied to the rise of literacy and the emergence in the 19th century of something close to near universal literacy. Think about how transformative that was. I think the digital revolution really pales by comparison when you think about what it meant for something that was utterly secret and privileged to a very few people, that is the ability to read and write, to suddenly become so widespread. Suddenly, you know, by in the 19th century, in the United States, where literacy really expanded quite dramatically over the space of a few decades, what was once secret, looked like a cryptogram to almost everybody, could suddenly be read by nearly everyone. And the mail was really the sort of thing that interrupted your privacy, that came through this slot in your door, these letters that were little containers, envelopes that contained some other self, some other person's very soul. And so the reading of the mail, this terrific story, I was fascinated by the NSA story because it reminded me so much of this Giuseppe Mazzini story from 1844, when this Italian revolutionary living in London became suspicious because his mail was always arriving late and the stamp seemed kind of funky and fishy looking. He became suspicious that the government was reading his mail, so he conducted an experiment. He put little grains of sand and strands of hair and poppy seeds in envelopes to letters he sent both to friends of his and to himself. And his friends got the mail and the stuff was still in it, but when we opened up his mail, there were no poppy seeds, no strands of hair, and no grains of sand. And so he went to Parliament and said, the government's been reading my mail. And it turned out he was right.
Now, was Mazzini a good analog to Edward Snowden? Are they similar in a way that you see?
No, they have nothing to do with one another in the sense that Mazzini was a longstanding political activist. He had quite courageously attempted to unify the kingdoms of Italy and form an Italian republic. He had been arrested many times. He had been sentenced to death in absentia, and he was living in exile in London. He was actually attempting to discover the nature of the secret, what turned out to be a secret department of the post office. He didn't know that of its existence. He suspected it. It was the investigation that was launched as the result of a complaint that he lodged that led to Parliament forming a committee of secrecy that conducted an investigation that revealed, in fact, that there was a secret department of the post office, that opening people's mail had been done for centuries. It had been, this sort of historical report was commissioned that traced this practice back much farther in time back, Todd, than even you or I would be interested to know.
Would consider history, yeah. But you can certainly see the parallels, though, even though their methods were different, between, you know, the investigation that followed in this case and all of a sudden the public becoming aware that the government was reading mail for hundreds of years, and the compressed timetable of this scenario where, even though it was a leaker, the public all of a sudden learns that the government has the ability to read emails going back at least till 2007.
And I think the other parallel that's really interesting is everyday people getting mail was a new thing, in the same way that email is a relatively new thing now, or all the ways in which we use the internet that are being tracked. So it's in a sense the novelty of the problem that's a parallel between 1844 and today. And so there's a big debate in the 19th century about the very nature of privacy and the nature of what at the time was called publicity, which word meant at the time what we would use the word transparency for. So people in Parliament and political reformers made great claims for the need for publicity in the 1840s, that is to say, to make public what the government was doing. Some members of Parliament said, well, if the government's going to be reading people's mail, that's fine, so long as they notify us if they're reading our mail. You know, Disraeli said, I don't mind if the government reads my mail, so long as they would answer it for me.
Well, flash forward to today, Jill Lepore. And you talk about a culture where so much is public, so much is based on publicity, especially online, where people strive for publicity, putting their private thoughts and their private actions on public websites, and at the same time are obsessed with privacy.
Yeah, I mean, isn't the real story here not the NSA, but our illusion of privacy protection in a commercial and increasingly commercial experience on the internet? Right? Like, think about the ways in which we have yielded all kinds of what in another era we might have considered private affairs to that web that catches all that information, and how much we volunteer, we ourselves place on that web. So publicity today means attention that we seek out, right? Like the attention of the press or the attention that you get when you post something on Twitter. And we celebrate that. It's a driving engine of many people's days in a way that is really unimaginable, say, in the 19th century. So we have a very different relationship between privacy and publicity today than ever before.
Do you think maybe President Obama understands that when he sort of reassures or tells Americans, as he did in an interview last night, look, freedom is not on the ropes here. Everybody relax. We need security. But essentially, trust us. Maybe he understands that just because the NSA is potentially listening doesn't mean it's actually any less private than things were before.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think what he's relying on is the trust that consumers have in the information that they disclose every second of every day to Google and Facebook and what have you, that there is a kind of passivity about what one yields up into the world. And if anything, I think he's maybe leveraging off that. And I'm not sure that's a good thing, but the two really can't be separated.
Jill Lepore is professor of American history and a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her article on the history of privacy and individual freedom is in this week's magazine. And we're hearing from you. What does freedom mean in modern day America? Steve from South Carolina tweets us that freedom is the ability to do what I want as long as I harm no one else. We want to hear your definition of freedom. Finish this sentence. Freedom to me is blank. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us, of course, at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.